So those are the things that made you cringe. It wasn't the idea of a 17-year-old stripping for an 80-year-old woman. You were good with that. Hello, Addison.
Hey, Billy. I'm excited. We're covering Landman. This is our first in, I wouldn't say only, but I guess only in the sense of this was the season finale until potentially season two of Landman.
The response was strong. We asked people if they wanted us to cover Landman, and I think people overwhelmingly said yes. It's still a very new show to a lot of people, so I don't sort of expect the sort of robust conversation that we had for Yellowstone, but, you know, I kind of hope to get there. And in my mind, the show is as good, if not better, than early Yellowstone.
I really enjoyed it. And even now, after watching it, I admit my – so Papa Jay, as we've talked in Yellowstone episodes, he is an oil and gas law professor at Texas Tech. He used to be in it before he became a professor. And over Christmas break, which now looking back, I'm like, man, I actually should have paid more attention to these conversations. My papa was going down a rabbit hole trying to explain, like, when you're – drilling for oil on land, and let's say someone sells the land, but it's deeded to the kids if the person's passed, yada, yada, yada. Anyways, all this stuff that was really going over my head in the moment, where now after watching Landman, I was like, oh, I probably should have paid more attention.
You're going to go back to school on the show just to, I mean, you got to be doing the research now, kind of getting your credentials here. Like I have done with previous shows. I'm going to put that onus on you for Landman as a series. There's your homework assignment.
That's fair. I this one seems slightly easier to me than like market equities in Yellowstone, only because I grew up in Austin. Grandparents have always lived in Lubbock, and just the oil and gas world has been at least somewhat in my ear that I don't feel completely like fracking. You recently learned about that this last episode, right?
I thought the way they explained fracking was really good. Mm-hmm. I hadn't totally understood what fracking was. I needed talk to me like I'm five about fracking. And Billy Bob Thornton kind of does. He explains that there's layers of shale. That's your bread. And between that is the oil, which is your butter. And then they pump salt water to kind of free up that oil. And there's your money. Like, I needed it really sort of simplified to me, because we've been talking about fracking in this country for decades now, at least a couple of decades. And I kind of got an idea. It's somewhat controversial in different areas, although it doesn't go into that too much. But now I understand it quite a bit more.
Well, let's, before we kind of go down all the different rabbit holes here, let's maybe big picture talk about what happened in the season finale. And I personally want to start by saying, hot take, this was not the finale episode I was expecting to be a finale. I kind of, like, it was boring.
I'm kind of in the same boat, but what do you mean by that? Like, what were you expecting? What didn't happen? And, like, are you kind of disappointed, excited? Like, where are you at?
I guess maybe I should say I'm in the middle. Everything with the cartel, all of that, I just felt like was already known. So I don't feel like I learned more other than it was a very interesting scene in which they got Tommy and kind of threatened him. Like, it does make me – that made me feel like, okay, there's more to be unpacked there that obviously we didn't – there's no resolution. That's great. But I think Ainsley and Angela – I don't know. I just kind of felt mediocre about where we ended with them. Kind of no resolution in maybe like their characters and where they're at.
What it kind of ended like? It ended like a show that wasn't sure if it was coming back for season two.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise I think there probably would have been a big cliffhanger. And we'll get into kind of the details exactly what went on with this episode, and then talk about season two in a little bit. But I agree with you to a certain extent. Like, things I was expecting to happen, like I expected, like after the scene with the old folks at the strip club, I expected someone. I thought the cartel might be operating out of the same club, so I thought there'd be some interaction, and that didn't happen. Then I thought one of those old folks might have a heart attack that might make it all sad, and that didn't happen. But ultimately, I was happier for that. Like, I was glad like those predictable things didn't happen for a scene that was kind of inconsequential. And I also anticipated the cartel guy would get to Tommy, but totally didn't see how that was going to play out. I thought there would be a cliffhanger there where Tommy would remain sort of captive to season two.
Yeah.
And I was good with that not happening, though. Like, I was content.
I do like the ending scene where I know that you've called it a wolf in the past, and we now know. Let me say, not we. I'm not putting myself in that. I knew it was a coyote. I'm going to say you now know that it was a coyote. I do think that part was my favorite, where Tommy walks out in the backyard. He's smoking a cigarette, and there's this coyote, and he's saying, you know, be careful. They kill coyotes out here. And I do think it's interesting how, like, Yellowstone, it was the wolf and Casey, and how that was connected. Here's a coyote. And I'm kind of curious. I'm like, is this foreshadowing for something? Or I might have just looked way too deep into something that's not.
Okay. Well, let's start there, I guess, because okay. I think this is a question a lot of people have. What you're referring to, I called it a wolf accidentally during a preview video, an episode 10 preview video we did where we were talking about episode 9 and Tony and Tommy's encounter with the animal. Yeah, it's a coyote. I said wolf. I said the wrong thing. And people kind of jumped down my throat on YouTube about it. My bad. Apologize. I know it's a coyote. I just, you know, misspoke. I think it's a symbol for either Tommy's the one killing the coyotes, like he kind of alludes to, or he is the coyote and things are attacking him. So it's one of the two right now, and we don't really know which one it is at this point, but it's definitely symbolic. And that's kind of what I came to, but also I think I read Christian Wallace, who's the co-creator of the show. I think he said as much in one of the interviews he gave after the show, either to a Variety or the Hollywood Reporter. It's a good analogy, and it is very similar to Yellowstone because there was that whole Casey and the wolf thing, which was very symbolic. And I think it's similar in that sense. You know, Taylor likes doing certain things. He's gonna do them the same way, I guess. But
something that did surprise me, and I'm kind of, I hate to say I'm glad it happened, but I think it allowed the anticipation to continue. And I just like that it didn't end necessarily how I thought it was ending. But to have, oh my gosh, what's the name of the guy who died? I'm blinking also.
Monty,
yeah. To have Monty die, that changed the trajectory of obviously where they're at now, what they're having to do. I hate to say it, I like that he died, but it created kind of dysfunction in a, you've piqued my interest. Is that bad to say?
No, it isn't. And I'm glad a main character died and it does some great things and it opens up Demi Moore's character, Cammy, to be more of a presence in season two, if there is one. Let's back up just a little bit and kind of go through from this episode from maybe at the start, which started with Monty in the hospital. At the end of episode 9, we weren't sure if he lived or died because he had a heart event. We learned he lived through that, but he had surgery to repair a ruptured aortic aneurysm. And he needs a heart transplant is what we find out. Very touch and go. Not sure if he can make it more than a few days, if a couple of weeks to get that heart transplant. And then at that point, Tommy takes over as president of MTEX. And he also has to be the executor on the family's will, which is pretty interesting. I imagine that's going to weigh on him to a certain degree as we kind of move along. But we go to the very end of the episode where they show the family once again hovering over Monty's body. And some people weren't sure if he died. And I got to admit, I kind of was unsure myself, but there were a few clues. One, that the EKG machine was flat, but also that same interview I just referred to with Christian Wallace, he says, yeah, he died. He dead.
Oh, interesting. So people thought that scene where his two daughters were crying, Demi Moore's character's crying, that...
They didn't think it was definitive.
Oh, interesting.
And I can understand that to a certain degree. I mean, John Hamm on this show was good. The character was great, but he wasn't why I tuned in. It'll be curious to see what Demi Moore's character can kind of bring to the action moving forward. But, you know, a show like this, I feel like there has to be a sort of a character death at some point. So I guess of all of them, I'm glad it was him.
I do think Cammy is Demi Moore's character, right?
That's right. Yeah.
it's so funny. I am so insecure about names where I think I'm confident and then I'll say something and then it's wrong. So that's why I just need to be affirmed, Billy. But I don't think Monty's family is interesting enough that I like want to see more scenes of them. Like, no offense to Demi Moore, but I'm kind of like, what are you going to provide? Like, it's kind of Tommy now calling the shots and whether, you know, to sell things, not to sell things, how to run Monty's business.
I would agree. I hope they kind of continue to remain periphery characters. But, you know, I think there's some people that disagree. Angela and Ainsley had a pretty big part of this episode, although nothing really dramatic happened to them. They succeeded in their plan of taking all the old timers to the strip club, which is just amazing and hilarious and a bit uncomfortable at different points. And everybody that goes really loves it and has a good time. And like I said, nobody dies, which is made me feel good. People are really conflicted on Angela and Ainsley and actors Ellie Larder and Michelle Randolph. Some people love them. Some people hate them. Like, they're a little bit divisive.
Well, I just want to first talk about the strip scene where Michelle Randolph, Ainsley's boyfriend, Ryder, who's played by Mitchell Slaggart, I think is how you pronounce his last name.
I think so too.
Okay, let me just get this off my chest because this is what I was thinking the whole time. I'm like, he's supposed to be what, 17 in this movie? Yeah. What 17-year-old is looking like he's about 35? When I saw that, I was like, no boy when I was 17 years old was looking like that. I mean, Ryder looks like he needs to go pay a mortgage. Like, he's not worried about, you know, puberty or what am I going to get on my math score? I mean, Ryder is straight up looking like I said, he's trying to handle real world problems. That's all I kept thinking about in that scene. I was like, you are not 17 years old.
It is weird how both he and Michelle Randolph are like 10 years older than their characters. Because I think I would say the same thing about her character, Ainsley. She does not look like when guys mature, like, you know, obviously guys mature. Some guys mature quickly, some don't. Like, it's weird. It's like a weird maturation. They get hairy and like it's patchy hair. And it's still sort of, it's not like he's like sleek and cut and looks like he would look great on a Men's Health magazine cover or look good in a suit in a boardroom.
Yes.
Talking about my finances.
Yes. That was my only qualm I had the whole time. I was like, this is so unrealistic. I can't get into my head that he's 17 years old. Also, oh my gosh, in that scene where he's doing his thing for the old ladies, when Angela, and she does not just do this with him, but I was like, oh gosh, this is just weird. When she goes, baby, she calls all the men baby, and something about calling a 17-year-old man baby, I was like, don't love this.
So those are the things that made you cringe. It wasn't the idea of a 17-year-old stripping for an 80-year-old woman. Like, you were good with that?
Well, I think because of the fact that never have I been watching Ryder and thinking, oh, you're 17 years old. It was just in the strip scene that it like came to me that I was like, oh, wait, you're supposed to be playing a 17-year-old? No, it actually doesn't bug me, which maybe I should be more concerned that it doesn't bug me.
I did an article at Taste of Country. I think it was titled, Am I a Prude or Did This Landman Scene Go Too Far? And I'm talking specifically about this scene with Ryder and Ethel is the old lady's name. Like, okay, teen dramas, teen love stories, there's always like teens on teens. And like, that's like a thing that happens in cinema. Adults are fine. But I think when you intersect teens and adults, you kind of get to a creepy, like weird American Beauty, Kevin Spacey type space that at best is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But they kind of just power forward with it, like some pretty brash ways with this show.
So are people not loving Angela and Ainsley because why?
So I have some thoughts on this. I do like Angela and Ainsley. But I think you have to be willing to identify the depth of their character. Like, they're really easy to just look at as caricatures. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what Angela was the first couple of episodes. She just appeared on Tommy's phone and she was always like, like coming right at you and like wild. But like throughout the series, like you've seen a lot of depth to her character. She's sensitive. She's kind of complicated. She wants certain things. I think the scenes with her as a mother to Cooper are really informative. So yeah, she's really wild and impulsive. Then you get Ainsley, who is sort of a lesser version of that. She's sort of coming along, but even she has a little bit of depth. And I thought maybe we saw a little more of that at the very end of the episode when it seems like she's forming a real relationship with Ryder. But if you're not sort of aware of that or willing to sort of accept that that could be sort of a thing, then all Angela and Ainsley are eye candy who are sort of always tramping about the place. And gosh, I think you're missing a lot in this show if you're not willing to sort of embrace Angela, especially as more well-rounded character, because the acting is really good and there's some depth there that is a little hard to find, but it really makes her interactions with Tommy a lot more compelling.
I do think they leaned for both Ainsley and Angela. They lean really heavy into their sexuality that I do think therefore kind of makes them, I think people naturally get more stuck on that, which does not, yes, I agree with you of Angela. I started seeing depth, but I think it's so heavy on the sexuality that it gets like when she is deep, it gets a little bit lost. Like I do wish that it was watered down just a little bit more than it ended up being.
Yeah. I think that's fair. So I think that's where people get stuck on them and where the division is. And that could sort of change. I think season two, now that they've lived in the character and seen the response, they might have a different approach to those characters moving forward. So they could sort of slowly evolve. But I like the starting spot. I thought the starting spot is really interesting and the acting is good. And that's easy to sort of come back to earth a little bit from than if the acting is bad, which, you know, sometimes that's the case.
So I have a hot take.
Hit me.
And it's nothing personal to Michelle Randolph, if she happens to ever listen to this podcast. I liked her. I think her acting was stronger in 1923 than it is in Landman. And it might be because it's a completely different character, but I just felt like she did a better job and it was a little bit more believable, where sometimes I feel like it with Landman, and I know she's supposed to be playing a 17-year-old. Like I hear that. And in 1923, she was not. And she was going through things like miscarriages and stuff that Ainsley is not going through.
I think the acting was the same, but I think the part she was asked to play naturally allows her to be a little bit deeper on Landman or on 1923.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is.
Those life events.
Yeah.
And she's not going to be, if someone on the show wins an award, it's probably not going to be Michelle Randolph. I think she's holding it down for now.
The interactions I did really like was Ariana and Cooper. I think they did a couple that Taylor Sheridan wrote really well. I love how you're seeing this, because at first when Ariana's husband dies and, you know, she's interested in Cooper, I did feel like, ooh, this is too soon. It almost feels wrong. But then they've done a really good job, especially in this episode. You see Ariana starting to go through her husband's clothes and then she gets to, you know, the wedding album and old photos, and you can tell she's deeply, deeply grieving. And she's at this kind of fork in this road of holding both like love for Cooper, but then also grieving her husband and the love that genuinely was there. And so she's not tossing him to the curb. And I think this show has done a really good job of showing and holding space for two different emotions and different struggles. And I've just really, I enjoy the depth and just walking through complicated emotions with this couple.
I think you described that really well. They weren't a huge part of episode 10. I didn't think they were a little bit of garnish, but I don't mean that in a pejorative way. Mm-hmm. Their scenes were still pretty compelling. The bulk of their action, I think, has already come in season one. So now they're just kind of in the figuring it out stage. The chemistry is very real between them. And how can you not love Cooper, the guy who's just like hanging in there and going through all of his new girlfriend's memories with her late husband after like a month, and he's 22 years old. Like, that's just kind of a really endearing thing for him to do.
Yeah.
And conversely, I think it's her willingness to share that I think is equally endearing. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to come of this couple. Marriage seems kind of hokey, right? Like, I feel like at some point this is a Taylor Sheridan show. Something awful has to happen to one of them, right?
Yeah. Well, no. I think it could. There's other characters that something could happen to.
I don't know. Cooper just seems like a tragic character. Like, doesn't he even just look kind of tragic? Like, he looks like the kind of thing bad things would happen. Kind of guy bad things would happen to.
He's kind of in my eyes, except he's wiser than this character I'm about to say, Jimmy from Yellowstone.
Yeah,
where something's always happening to Jimmy. Yes. Cooper is that of Landman, but smarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really apt comparison. He's got a great plan to make money and to start his business, and we sort of see stage two of that, which I guess is a little bit of a continuation of what we saw in episode 9. Do you kind of understand the nuts and bolts of what Cooper is trying to do?
No, and funny that you said that, because I was watching the episode last night, and I literally thought in my head, I need to call Papa Jay and ask him, like, is this actually a thing?
Yeah. So I think he's essentially trying to cobble together all these sort of unwanted wells that have been drilled, but not drilled deep enough to produce any longer.
They're small, right? Or they're fully dry?
Oh, I don't know if they're fully dry. I think they're just not drilled deep enough to produce. So they're not pumping very much. And no one wants them individually because they're not very big and there's not much land there. So he's kind of cobbling them all together and hopes to sell them to a big oil company who will come in and make the investments to drill deeper and provide these homeowners with a pretty good paycheck, and then Cooper as well. And then he's going to kind of progress from there. So on paper, it seems like it's a pretty good plan. Now, one question I asked people, though, was like, what's the flaw here? Like,
yeah,
it's not going to go perfect for him. He's not going to be a billionaire by the end of next season. So like, what am I not seeing? And I think that's a blind spot for both you and I, because, you know, we haven't worked in the patch. Maybe Papa Jay knows.
Maybe Papa Jay knows. I would say we could have him on the podcast, but he is one of my best friends, but he is definitely an older individual who you know, when you ask one question and somehow an hour later, they've gone about 8 rabbit trails. So he's not meant for the podcast, but I really might call him and ask him, like, is this, and also he has a flip phone that he barely uses. So I don't think technology wise, we're ever going to get Papa Jay on a podcast, but I might call and ask him because I am kind of curious.
Yeah, just give me a summary of it. I appreciate that. A little succinctity.
Yeah. For your sake and mine, and for those listening, when Papa Jay isn't coming on the podcast.
At the beginning of this episode, did you recognize the voiceover?
Which part?
It was a radio guy, an old radio guy telling a story. Oh. Uh-uh. About the oil business and the news and opinions on it. Did you recognize who that was?
Mm-mm.
Did you ever listen to Paul Harvey?
Mm-mm. Should I?
Well, he's dead now. Are you aware of who Paul Harvey is?
No.
All right. Well, totally fair, because I think certainly speaks to an older generation. But like, imagine like the most influential like news person you can possibly think of in America today.
Okay.
And then sort of multiply that by like a factor of 2 or 4. Like, that's who Paul Harvey was. He did radio news and commentary for like 60 years. I kind of love the man, because I have a lot of memories of like driving around listening to him with my dad when I worked at a radio station. We used to run Paul Harvey. One thing I like to tell people about Paul Harvey is when he, in the year 2000, he went and renegotiated a 10-year deal worth $100 million from, I think, like CBS Radio. And he was 90 years old at the time when he did that. So someone was willing to give a 90-year-old $100 million to be on the radio twice a day. He didn't see the full contract out, but he got through most of it. But that was his voice at the end. Oh, and he just has like this presence about him, almost like Jerry Jones did during his acting. That's sort of, and the breadth of what he's talked about, you could insert a Paul Harvey clip into basically any episode of any type of show you wanted to. He's like that influential and recognized amongst that older generation. Totally bit of an aside there. I just loved hearing him because I think the voice is fantastic. And I thought that was a really cool reference. And good on Taylor Sheridan for sort of finding that little bit of radio history to insert into his show.
That's actually really cool. I also really did like Jerry Jones's. I didn't realize that was completely unscripted.
I didn't either at the time and in real time. Like, but that was, I think that came out of The Hollywood Reporter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it did.
But yeah, they just brought him in there for the day, and he did that in just a take. And Billy Bob Thornton sort of watched in real time, was just sort of transfixed and memorized. And, you know, it was really strong.
And especially too, and this is no shade to Carrie Underwood, but anytime I think of now she's a singer, but any cameo by a celebrity, I watch Carrie Underwood in Soul Surfer. And let's just say, I'm so glad Carrie Underwood has an amazing voice. The acting was awful. And like Jerry Jones, genuinely, and maybe because he wasn't going, like he was speaking about something that is true to him, like he wasn't having to play a part. I am really impressed. I think people were also joking that I've never been a major Cowboys fan, and I know, yeah, I grew up in Texas. Like, what are you doing? But I'm just not a big NFL girl. A lot of people were saying, man, he like maybe should go into acting instead of being, you know, over the Cowboys. It's a joke, but you know, because right, the Cowboys are always iffy if they're good or bad.
How about Carrie Underwood catching a stray on this podcast today? Ouch.
I know. Sorry. No, I love Carrie. You got the voice of an angel. And granted, like Soul Surfer was what came out in maybe 2000. Like it's been 25 years. Actually, that was probably too far away. But anyways, my point being is like maybe she got better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just historically, when a big actress act, I mean, sorry, not actress, a big celebrity does a cameo, it is not always the best.
Well, we talked about this with Lainey Wilson too. Like she got better between seasons. Oh,
significantly.
Yeah.
No,
like
I would
first
even.
Season was like, oh, that's Lainey Wilson. And the second season was like, oh, there's Abby.
Yes.
That was
yes.
Kind of the difference there.
1,000,000%. And also, I'm like, I'm tooting my own horn over here. Like, you put me on Landman, you're probably also going to go, Addison, just stick to your day job.
So the bulk of the last half of the episode kind of focused in on Tommy and the cartel. And it starts with him more or less getting kidnapped. Jimenez, mm-hmm. the henchman, blows up one of the wells. Tommy explains how that was really short-sighted because the cops are going to come and be all over that place for months on end. So they take him to one of the clubs and proceed to start torturing Tommy before who I think will be a big star in season two comes in and saves the day. Character's name is Galeno, and he is the cartel's leader, and he's played by Andy Garcia, who, as it turns out, is very good friends with Billy Bob Thornton.
And you know what? I'm never going to look at the same. I mean, you've said this as well. They come out at the end of behind a vending machine. Like the whole vending machine kind of slides out and there's a wall behind it that opens up. Billy, you best believe I'm going to be looking behind every single vending machine now. Like, is there a trap door? There's one at the YMCA where I work out. And I'm going to be peering behind it. I'm like, you know, the cartel could come out of there.
I loved that. I loved that moment. It was just sort of quietly cool.
I also am like, was that just like a creative touch point, or does Taylor Sheridan know something we don't know? And that's happened before. I'm just saying.
I'm sure he did his research. could you get through the torture sequence? Like it gave off vibes of being really gruesome, but I don't know how gruesome it actually was visually, but I know you struggle a little bit more with some of the violent scenes like that than I do.
I struggled with gore. I turned it down just enough that I could understand what was happening, but I can't tell you that I was paying attention. I was actually on Poshmark as the scene was happening. I just didn't want to watch it. But it wasn't – I'm just being honest here. But it wasn't – it wasn't bad.
Were you selling or were you buying on Poshmark?
I was selling.
Oh, okay. Good. So the couple takeaways with regards to this scene is now Andy Garcia has been introduced, and I got to think he'll stick around if there is a season two. A number of the write-ups and reviews that I read afterwards sort of referred to this idea that Tommy is somehow owned by the cartel now. Like Galeno saved his life, so Tommy owes him a favor. And I didn't get that sense. My takeaway was Galeno was coming in to sort of clean up the mess that Jimenez made, and he just wants to restore things to how they were sort of early in the season when everybody just stayed out of their way. You had losses. Yeah, there was trouble, but like they did with the drugs and the oil men did the oil, and like the two paths didn't need to cross so frequently. Like that was my takeaway. I didn't see any tension building up.
I did, in the sense that it's like Tommy can't ever be free of him. Like there's always going to be a give and a take.
Why do you think that is though? Like, I don't, what was said or done that made you think that he couldn't be free of the guy?
Wasn't he saying, he's like, you can't do what you do without me, and I can't do, like, we're in this together. We're more alike than we are different. We have the same enemies.
Yeah, but I didn't think he said that as sort of a threat. I thought he more just said that as sort of describing the reality of their businesses. I don't know.
I agree to disagree.
We'll find out. It's they seemed jovial at the end. I think that they'll probably butt heads again for sure, but I don't know necessarily. It's not like, to make another reference to another show, Breaking Bad, where Walter was very much owed. Walter was owned by Gus, so to speak, for many of the seasons. Like, I didn't feel like it was that sort of relationship at all. I feel like they're kind of equals a little bit, and not cartel up above Tommy and the oil. I'm making some really cool finger designs here that people can't see, but trust me, it's crystal clear on screen.
It totally makes sense. You know who was kind of put in her place a little bit? And I'm just like, can we give this woman a Xanax or just something, like, to take the edge off her? Rebecca, the lawyer. Yeah. She's kind of annoying me. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, you've proven your point. You're a badass. And we don't have to keep proving this point. Like, yeah. just calm down. Take a beat, right, girly.
She needs an on-off switch a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, crank that machine up when it's needed. Otherwise, like, what did I say? I think I said a couple of weeks ago, she needs to take a gummy. Like, she needs to just take a few. Maybe she needs to buy a little bit of what Galeno's selling and just chill a little bit. Like, just, not everybody's against you.
No, just take a beat for a minute, because every time she comes on screen, I'm like, okay, here we go.
I don't feel like she has very many friends.
Oh, heck no.
She'd be a hard person.
The warm and friendly. She's probably not dating anyone either.
No, 100% not.
Staff at tasteofcountry.com. I want to hear y'all's thoughts on this season finale. Even character thoughts. Did you like Angela Ainsley? Really, anything that we talked about here, do you agree with, disagree with, have additional thoughts? Are you in the oil and gas world and want to enlighten us on a few things? That's where you can leave them. But I do have some Q&A for us, if you don't mind if I'm...
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't do trivia this week because we're not going to have another episode next week. I think we'll probably pick the podcast back up again as we start a ramp up to the start of season two of 1923. So no trivia, but I did want to get to some Q&A because there were some pretty good points made and people actually answered some of the questions I had in the video that we can address here.
Cool. Yeah, I have three for us. The first one is, fortunately, I know enough Spanish to understand the cartel dudes when they talk to each other. By the way, they speak in pretty simple terms as far as Spanish is concerned.
I thought there was enough Spanish on the show that they needed captions.
I agree.
I needed the translation sometimes. Like, it wasn't just a word or two. Like, they seemed to be saying important things. So that would be really helpful to know Spanish.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
And maybe continue to be helpful carrying forward, because obviously we're right there on the border and it's going to be, you know, a second language.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. The second one I have for us is, my dad sold the mineral rights to his property. In addition to the royalties, he received a bonus of cash up front. This is what the flaw in Cooper's plan is as far as real life oil and gas patch are concerned. If anybody could walk onto a landholder's property and lease the minerals the way Cooper is doing it, then everyone would be doing it.
So that's informative, don't you think? Like, he's essentially saying it's too easy for Cooper. You got to give people cash up front to sort of secure these deals.
Yeah, and considering he's not coming with money.
If you also have some experience with dealing with oil and gas companies, or you've leased your land or signed some of these contracts, I just love some additional perspective at staffoftasteofcountry.com. Mm-hmm. People have, I think, told us that so far this show does a pretty good job of depicting the business, although it's pretty oversimplified and over-dramatized, which is 100% understandable. That's what television does. But I'd love to know some of those nuances.
And then the last one I have for us is about Angela and Ainsley. from Claudia, who says they both fit the description of, quote, dumb blonde or, quote, bimbo, and there's too much sex.
The 304s. Do you think there's a demographic sort of, like, if we were to do, like, a census of people's opinions of Angela and Aisley, do you think, like, the older audience would be more offended by them than the younger audience necessarily, or do you think I'm mistaken there? Claudia looked a little older. She looked, just based on her little YouTube avatar, she looked to be up there in years. So I was just kind of wondering if that's part of the deal.
No, because I even have been annoyed at times. I'm 29. So no. And I'm so glad I'm remembering this. So we recently, actually this past week, Evan Paul, who is the host of our Taste of Country Nights show, and I haven't shared this with you yet, Billy, Kane Brown was in studio, and he was saying that he's really enjoyed watching Landman, and his wife, Caitlin. She came in, now granted, she came in at episode 3. If we remember what happened in episode 3, it's Ainsley and Angela doing the aerobics workout video and pretty much, you know, just underwear, bra. And so she told Kane, she's like, of course I see why you like this movie. And he's over here going, he's like, no, babe, like, I promise this is not, he goes, I genuinely have loved watching this for like the oil and gas, like history purposes. He's like, it's really not that much. But my point being is, I think Caitlin's actually roughly my, she might be 30. Anyways, point being is she's roughly my, she's roughly my age as well. And she also seems low key annoyed with Angela and Ainsley. So I actually don't think it's an age thing. And to the point of like, there's too much sex. Let's just remember Yellowstone. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I don't know if there was as much sex on Yellowstone in like a single season. Here's the thing. Like, Angela and Angela, they just need something better to do.
Sorry,
like,
you just need... butchered their names. Angela and Angela.
You know what I'm talking about. Ainsley and Angela. Like, they need like a... Like, Ainsley needs to go get a job or something. Yes. Or like an intern. Like, they need another arena to sort of act. Right now, all we have from Ainsley is her acting with boyfriends.
Yes.
And that involves a lot of teen bedroom type stuff or parties. Yes. And Angela's, she's staying at home. Like, they need more to do. And I think maybe that ratio will balance out a little bit.
Yes, I 1,000,000% agree with you on that.
All right. staff@tasteofcountry.com is the email address. And we are going to come back, I think, first or second Monday or Tuesday of February. And we'll start to break down season 2 of 1923, which also stars Michelle Randolph as Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And who, by the way, told me that she has a broad idea of how John Dutton is related to her generation of Duttons. So maybe that'll become clear by the end of 1923. And we'll get to talk family tree.
Y'all, I do want to encourage you, if you haven't shared this podcast already, please share. That's how we spread the word and get to keep doing what we're doing. We always love fan interaction, have really appreciated that. And some of y'all have even shouted us out on Twitter and Instagram, and that's been definitely fun. We see everything. staff@tasteofcountry.com or even commenting on our YouTube videos is where we see all of that. Alrighty, y'all. Well, the Yellowstone Dutton Rules podcast is another fan-inspired Town Square Media podcast.
It is fan-inspired, Addison.
Thank you. I felt really good ending on that one.
See ya.
Bye.